Hello, and welcome to the Get Started with Film Photography podcast. My name is Graham Young, and today we have the fourth of four episodes on buying your first single-lens reflex camera. Today we are talking about all auto everything cameras of the 1990s and early 2000s. And these are really the pinnacle of film cameras. Now, I'm not saying that they're the best. I am saying that they're the most full-featured. And they are the cameras that really represent the end of the line for film photography from major manufacturers. Now, there are small manufacturers of cameras today. They are boutique manufacturers. Most of the new cameras being made today are in large format. But there are some new cameras being made today, but these are the last ones of the 35 millimeter line of cameras. As I said, this is the fourth episode in a four episode series. In the first episode, it was a general discussion of the single lens reflex camera, how to identify it, how to check to see if it's working. And then I talked about dividing them up into the three groups. And of course, today we'll be talking about that third group. The second episode was all manual SLRs up to the 1970s. Some of those had light meters. Some of those did not have light meters. Then the last episode, episode three, was about manual focus, electronically controlled exposure cameras. And those are the cameras of the 1980s. Today, it's the auto everything camera of the 1990s and the early 2000s. As I talked about in the last episode, auto exposure, controlled by electronics, allowed for a much more accurate exposure system. And the two major modes of shooting at that time were aperture priority, where the user controlled the aperture and the camera controlled the other two legs of the exposure triangle, the setting for the film speed and the shutter speed. Then there was shutter priority, where the user controlled the shutter speed and the camera controlled the aperture and the film speed setting. Then there was full auto, where the camera kind of guessed at what it was that you wanted to do. And then there was finally program, and program was designed really for the camera to figure out, to kind of pay attention to how you were shooting, and then figure out what that exposure would be. And it was done through programming in the chip system. And then the last one was program. Now, program was a system by which the camera kind of paid attention to how you were shooting and made suggestions and set the camera to aperture and shutter speeds that made sense for the way that you were shooting. Now, that's taken further in the auto everything cameras that we're going to talk about today. During the 1980s, as they were developing the auto exposure cameras, they conceived of other things that the electronics could control. So, things like self-timers. Remember I talked about in the last episode the self-timer lever being the self-destruct lever of the camera because it didn't get much use and therefore all of those lubricants would gel up and stop the camera. Well, if you have electronics controlling that, then that whole self-destruct mechanism is removed, that all that clockwork is removed, and it's all controlled electronically. Auto advance was one of the other things that they talked about in the 1980s, and that was essentially you press the button and then the battery and the motor in the camera advance the film to the next frame. Now, there were always auto winders, and they were special accessories that would fit on the bottom of the camera and would attach to the, there was usually a little socket for a motor drive that would attach to the bottom of the camera. So you could shoot and shoot and shoot, and it would automatically wind the camera for you. Auto advance was something that actually started being built into cameras in the 90s and 2000s. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. Multiple exposures. So on a camera, on a 35 millimeter camera, previous to the 1990s, in order to prime the shutter, which is put the shutter back into its position. Remember, the shutter moves up and then another shutter curtain moves up. In order to move them both back down and in sequence so the film's not exposed, you would need to use the advance lever. The problem with that is the advance lever is connected to the film advance. So if you wanted to do, wanted to take multiple exposures on the same frame, the workaround that I've used quite often that is really horrible and does not work very well is you would press the clutch for the rewind system and then advance the film and it would only cock the shutter. It wouldn't advance the film. Or you pull the advance lever, it would cock the shutter and not advance the film. Well, that didn't work very well. I've tried it many times and it didn't work very well. But if you are electronically controlling your shutter and it's an electronically powered shutter, well, there is no priming that needs to happen. All you have to do is press the button and it'll run again. Rapid fire exposures. Now, we could, as I said, we had auto winders, but rapid fire auto winding was still that one exposure. Or if you're on shutter priority, the camera would continually read. Well, rapid fire exposures combines those two things together and it can predictively figure out what the next exposure will be right in time for the next frame to be exposed. Last minute exposure adjustments. So one of the things, I think we've all had this happen, or if you're just a beginning photographer, you haven't yet had it happen, but it'll happen to you. You've set your exposure, you're ready to go, you've focused, you've framed, you're just about to take the picture, and a cloud rolls in, and your exposure is completely off. Well, with electronically controlled exposure, just before that shutter is released, it can completely adjust all of those settings, so it's not a problem at all, and you can effectively take that picture without any penalty. Built-in flash was something that we saw quite a bit in travel cameras of the 1980s, but we didn't see them in single-lens reflex cameras. The flash unit was a unit that was an external accessory, and it would usually sit on top of the camera on what we call the hot shoe, and it was controlled by communication with the camera or not. Maybe some of those needed to be manually set. Depends on the era of the camera and the era of the flash. With all these electronic controls, we could create little tiny pop-up flashes that would fire when needed. In fact, they will automatically pop up when needed. Now, if you use a digital single-lens reflex camera, you know all about these. But they were not on the market in the 1980s, and in the 1990s, they were on almost every one of those autofocus cameras that was sold. One of the things that we could do is predictive program settings. Now, I've talked about the program mode. Predictive program settings allow a camera to pay attention to how you're adjusting the camera, how far away the objects are because it knows how far away because of where it's focusing or where you're focusing. And it can adjust the exposure. It can adjust different settings within the camera to help out for the next picture. So if you are, say, you're at a high school track meet and the contestants, the participants are running towards you, then you're starting to focus closer and closer and closer and closer. The camera can figure that out so that the next place it's going to try to autofocus is that same distance closer to you. You know, it'll look, oh, we're at infinity, then we're at 50 feet, then we're at 30 feet, then we're at 10 feet. Then, you know, it can automatically predict where that next location will be. So that will help you out and it will make the autofocus fire a little bit more quickly. And I'll talk more about autofocus as we move on. And, well, actually, that brings us to autofocus. The biggest promise of all, and the biggest thing that we could control, the biggest revolutionary change, is autofocus. Now, autofocus was the big revolution in the industry for these cameras. It frees the photographer to frame the image and maybe make some adjustments to the exposure, but not worry about focus. It made a camera of the era into a point-and-shoot camera. And what I mean by that is you would point it and you would shoot it. You didn't have to think about the focus. You didn't have to decide whether or not to get focus here or focus there. It automatically set the focus for you. Now, autofocus had a long and slow development. One of the first deployments in a commercially available camera was the 1978 Polaroid SX-70 sonar. Sonar, what do we know about sonar? It's sound waves. An SX-70 sonar would send out a ping of sound in above our hearing level. It would bounce off objects, and of course, the camera would measure the time it would take for that sound to bounce back, and it would set the focus to whatever that distance was. The problem with sonar as a focusing system for a camera is if you're in your car and you're pointing it out the window at something going past your car, you're going to be focusing on the glass. It is all about barriers and what can reflect sound and what can't reflect sound. The system worked fairly well. I remember my grandfather had one in the early 1980s. He had one of those cameras and he took a lot of pictures with it. And by and large, they came out fine. I don't remember there being any problem with it. It was an effective system, but it wasn't necessarily the best system. The early 35mm single lens reflex deployments of autofocus technology was a unit that would be mounted to the lens. And in fact, they would about double the width of a lens. So instead of a round barrel, you would have a big oblong shape and it would go off to one side or the other, the left or the right. Some of them were zoom autofocus lenses and there would be a button to zoom in and a button to zoom out on those lenses. They were slow. They were heavy. They needed power and so they weren't very functional for walking around. I don't think I've ever used one, but as I understand it, as I've been told, they about doubled the weight of your camera. So it was really, there was a big penalty for that autofocus. Manufacturers decided that they needed to bring the autofocus system into the full camera system. The early ones were just units that would sit on the front of another camera. They decided they needed to have integrated systems. They needed lenses that would talk to the bodies and bodies that would talk to the lenses. Each one of the major camera manufacturers of the time, and right now we're going to go down to Canon, Minolta, Nikon, and Pentax. At this point, Olympus kind of jumped out of this game. They did not go heavily into autofocus single lens reflex cameras. So they were a side runner. They're still alive today. They're still working fine today. But they did not go heavily into the autofocus single lens reflex camera market. All the four camera manufacturers designed bodies and lens systems that went together. Canon is the only one that completely abandoned their old lens mount and lens system. The new Canon EOS, and I forget exactly what it stands for, electronic something or other. The new Canon EOS cameras were completely new lens mounts. You could not use the old lenses on the new lens mount. You could use adapters, but the adapters required a little focusing element in the adapter, and that reduced the quality of the image. And it was generally considered not a good idea to adapt those old original Canon lenses to the autofocus cameras. Some of the manufacturers put the autofocus motors in the lens. Other manufacturers put the autofocus motors in the body of the camera. The advantages of putting the motor in the lens is it could work faster. It was a much faster system to have that motor in the lens. The disadvantage is it was a much more expensive system to have that motor in the lens. And I can remember looking at third-party lens manufacturers like Tamron and Sigma, and what they did was they would publish a price for the Pentax, Minolta, and Nikon versions of each lens. And then for the Canon version of that lens, it was 20% higher because they had to put motors in that lens. So that was one of the disadvantages of putting the motor in the lens as opposed to the motor in the body. That decision for Canon actually did put them out in front for a while, and they did reap the benefits of that, not necessarily in just more revenue because their lenses cost more, but because their lenses actually worked faster. And so they had an advantage in the early days of the autofocus 35mm SLR. Nikon, Pentax, Minolta, which later became Sony, they all were able to fight back to a certain degree, to a greater degree or to a lesser degree. And they really closed that gap. But there for a while, Canon was out front in the market. One of the things I want you to take from this episode is that the electronics that they stumbled with a little bit in the 80s really allowed camera manufacturers to greatly increase the number of features that they could offer in cameras. And these cameras of the 1990s they're feature laden. Let's say that they're feature laden. There are features jammed into these that you would never know. I wanted to use as an example a Canon, an early one of the cameras. And the one that I chose was a Canon EOS Elan. And I believe it was the Canon 30 other locations, other than North America, but it was the Elan in North America. And the original Elan, and one of the reasons why I chose that is that was my first autofocus camera. And I got mine in 1994, I believe. Yes, 1993 or 1994, I got my first autofocus camera, and it was an EOS Elan, as I said. They came out in 1991, so they were early in the production run of these autofocus feature-laden cameras. But I really wanted to impress upon you what kind of features they had. So I went to Orphan Cameras, and it's now cameramanuals.org, but you can look up Orphan Cameras or Mike Butkus, and you can find the camera manuals for these cameras. So I looked it up, and let me give you a good example of what type of manual this is. I have a camera from the era that immediately preceded this, from the 1980s. It's called a Leica CL. And that camera had a manual that was 8 pages long. It was very, very succinct. It was very, very short, but there weren't very many features. In comparison, the manual that I looked up for the EOS Elan, maybe 5 years later, it's a 78-page manual, and this is just a lightly feature-laden example. So let's go over these features in the Canon EOS Elan. First of all, it had a built-in pop-up flash, and that built-in pop-up flash would send out more light or less light depending on how far away the subject was. And of course, it knew how far away the subject was from the autofocus. So it would get really good flash images. Let's talk about the exposure modes that it had available. It had manual, and in manual, you set the shutter speed and the aperture, and the film speed would already be set. It had shutter priority, where you set the shutter and the camera took care of the aperture. It had aperture priority, where you set the aperture and the camera took care of the shutter speed. It had program AE, and I described that a little bit earlier in the podcast. It had depth of field AE. And what that means is the auto exposure would select for depth of field, for the longest depth of field it could get. So it would leave the aperture as small as possible, as long as possible. It had auto exposure bracketing. And what you would do with that is it would automatically figure out what the exposure was. Then you would press the button and it would take one frame at the exposure it figured was right, then one frame underexposed, then one frame overexposed. And that auto exposure bracketing, you could set it to 1/3 of a stop up and 1/3 of a stop down, all the way to 2 full stops in 1/3 increments. So it was very, very handy. It had an image zone, and in the image zone, full auto, a portrait mode, and portrait mode would try to keep the lens as wide open as possible to isolate the figure from the background. Landscape mode, once again, it would prefer to have a smaller aperture. Close-up mode, and I didn't use that very much because I didn't have very close focusing lenses. I'm not really sure what that does, but it's a close-up mode. Then it had a sports mode, and that sports mode would do what I talked about a little bit earlier. It would track the changes in the autofocus and maybe changes in the exposure, and it would decide, would predict what the next setting was. Then it had a barcode program. Now, you would have to buy an external accessory barcode reader. And if you had barcode program, you could change those image zone settings, those 5 image zone settings I just talked about. You could change them into some other setting that you wanted. So you could modify your camera. You could personalize your camera for certain shooting situations. This camera allowed multiple exposures on one frame, so it wouldn't advance the film, hold the film still, and shoot up to 9 exposures on one frame. And what you would do for that situation is, if you put 9 normal exposures on one frame of film, it's going to greatly overexpose that film, and that's not going to be good. So what you do is you meter the scene using the settings in the camera, switch to manual, and go 9 stops down. So essentially, set the camera to 1/4,000th of a second and F16 or F22, depending on the lens, and then shoot 9 frames. And that's just a guess. That's not necessarily what you would always do, but that's the idea. You would grossly underexpose, but then expose multiple times as you put it through. It had an accessory shutter release, so you could stand away from the camera, press that shutter release, and it would, either using radio, I believe it was radio, it could have been infrared, but it was using one of the systems, it would release the shutter. Now, that's really good if you like to take pictures of yourself. Now, this is the days before the selfie was invented, but if you wanted to put it on a tripod, take pictures of yourself, you could do that. Or if you wanted to leave the camera in one location and then take pictures as people walk by, so you could, you know, say it was a dangerous situation, you could mount your camera somewhere, say, near a car race track. And as the cars would come around the track, you could press that little button and take pictures up close. It had red eye reduction as part of its built-in flash system. It had different metering modes. Now, we haven't talked about metering modes so far. I will do an episode on metering and how to properly meter a scene. But the built-in light meter could be set to many different settings. The light meters of the previous generation were generally center-weighted light meters, which meant the middle 10% of the frame was a light meter. So you would move the frame around the scene and meter hot spots and shadows, and you could do all sorts of metering calculations as you took that picture. But that center weighted system is not necessarily always good. If there is some small bright object in the center of your frame, everything else is going to be underexposed because the exposure is going to be red from that small bright object. And that can work the other way too. So if you have a dark object in the center, but most of the rest of the frame is light, then you would get overexposed. This had three different metering modes. It had that spot mode. It had a center-weighted mode that was similar, but there was a little bit more calculation in it. And then there was evaluative metering. That's hard for me to say. So what it would do is it would evaluate the scene, and it would look for hotspots and shadows, and it would try to average all that stuff out so that you got a good final exposure. It had exposure compensation, which was a dial on the side. Well, it wasn't really a dial. It was all red off an LCD screen on the top of the camera. But you could set it using some of the dials on the back of the camera, and by pressing a button and pressing the dial, you could set these. The exposure compensation would allow the scene to be overexposed or underexposed in 1/3 stops, all the way from your center basic exposure to 2 stops up and 2 stops down. It had a self-timer that was electronic, so we've now lost our self-destruct lever. These are now electronic self-timers, and it would be run from the controls on the top of the camera. It had auto-advance, which means that there was a little motor that would advance the film and advance the film and advance the film and advance the film. And in fact, I don't remember whether this was one of the cameras, but many of the cameras in that Canon EOS line and in other lines, the first thing it would do when you loaded film is it would wind the film all the way out and then take the pictures essentially backwards on the roll. So the one towards the spool, the first one towards the spool is the first shot on the roll, and the second shot, you know, as opposed to the way that we normally do it, which is we would advance the film, pull it out of the cassette, and our first picture would be right there at the front. The advantage of this reverse advance system is that as you take pictures, they get rolled back into the canister. So if you get 10 pictures in and open up the back of the camera, sure, you're going to expose all of that film that hasn't yet been exposed, but all of those shots that you've already shot, with the exception of maybe the last one, are going to be protected inside that canister. It was really a good system. It would also count how many frames you had and then count down to 1 rather than from 1 up that we do on the manual cameras up to this point. So it was really a nice system, that auto advance. It would also auto rewind. So when it got to the end, it would rewind the film for you. Now, you could also set it so the tail was left out, so it wasn't rewound all the way into the canister. That would be its normal by default system. But you could set it so it would leave that tail out, And by leaving that tail out, you could then easily take it, load it into a film can and develop it without having to retrieve the leader. It had a single exposure auto drive or auto advance, I should say. It had either a single exposure auto advance or a continuous exposure auto advance where it would take a picture, take a picture, take a picture, take a picture, take a picture. So you could set that. So if you had it in the continuous mode, you would just hold your finger down and it would take the next picture as soon as it possibly could. Again, that's something that we see in modern digital single lens reflex cameras, but it was a revolutionary thing to have built into the body of a 35 millimeter SLR camera at that time. It had aperture and shutter speed settings that were set using thumb wheels and dials on the camera. There was one at the top of the camera right next to the shutter release button. And then there was one where your thumb sits, your right thumb sits on the back of the camera. So you could independently change the shutter speed and the aperture, or you could change some other settings on the fly as you're looking through the lens. You could make those settings changes. It electronically communicated with the lens, so there's no more aperture ring on the lens. There is a focus ring on the lens because we can set that lens to manual focus, but by and large, we don't even touch that. We just let it go. Now, the autofocus for this system, this Canon EOS system, it only used Canon EOS lenses or lenses that were manufactured by third parties to work with that system. They had a manual on-off switch for the autofocus mode, and they did have, as I said, an autofocus ring. They could also be set for one-shot autofocus or AI servo autofocus. And the AI servo autofocus was, again, for that sports situation where it would begin to predict where that next frame will be focusing. And it worked fairly well. It wasn't fabulously great, but it worked fairly well. And it really helped make sports photographers' lives considerably more easy for those situations. It could manually be set to ISO settings from 6 to 6400. Now, at this time, most of the film, again, was between 25 and 400 speed with a few 1600 and 3200 ISO films. It also had DX coding. Now, DX coding is a system that reads a pattern of black and silver marks on the film cassette and sets the ISO based on that pattern. So you can leave it, you can let it automatically set the ISO, or if you're somebody who rolls film into old film cassettes and the film that you've put in your cassette is a little bit different, you could also manually override the DX coding on this camera. The shutter speeds are just, these really are revolutionary. I have to be perfectly honest here. These are revolutionary shutter speeds. The fastest it would go is 1/4,000th of a second. That is pretty much as fast as a mechanical shutter will go. There are some that will go 1/8,000th of a second, but that's just one stop faster. That's not significantly faster. It is significantly fast, but the difference between 4,000 and 8,000 is just one stop. It would also give you shutter speeds. You could set it for shutter speeds over 1 second. Now, generally, 1 second is the longest that you will ever see on a single lens reflex camera dial. Almost always, the longest you'll see is 1 second. Now, I do have a couple of cameras that will go into up to 30 seconds on a manual setting on an electronically controlled shutter system from the 1980s as opposed to these autofocus cameras from the 90s, but they actually were built much later. They were built using the same technology that was pioneered. So the longest it would automatically work is 1/30th of a second. So if you figure 1 second is, we're going to start with that as our first stop. 2 seconds is one stop. 4 seconds is two stops. 8 seconds is three stops. 16 seconds is four stops. 30 seconds is five stops. It could go five stops slower than a 1 second exposure, which is incredible. Would do it either through the automatic exposure system or you could manually set that. This is incredible. It really is incredible. So, you know, as I said, I wanted to go through one camera just to talk about the features because these are incredibly feature-rich cameras. So they are very valuable from that point of view. I'm going to go ahead and take a break and I'll be right back. When these 35mm auto everything cameras came on the market in the early 90s, they immediately created demand. They had a great increase in functionality. They had a great increase in the range of shooting. I just talked about the shutter speeds. They had the autofocus promise. Never miss a shot. Don't think about focus. Now, I'm going to stop for a moment and say I never really found the autofocus promise to come through on any system that I have ever used in any mode. I don't believe in autofocus personally as something that I'm going to use. I have too often focused on the wrong thing and not known about it until I got home. And the camera made that decision. I would rather make the decision myself with a manual focus lens. And I would rather take the responsibility and not blame it on my equipment. That is now my responsibility. When I abandoned autofocus, and this was 2012 about, when I abandoned autofocus, I greatly improved my photography. I am not saying that that is a panacea, that that will work for you. That is something that I found with myself. So when I abandoned that promise, and I tried to live with that promise for 20 years, I tried to make that promise work for 20 years, and it didn't work for me. When I abandoned it, my pleasure in the photography that I created was greatly improved. However, autofocus is a heck of a great selling point. So, and it's been improved. It's been greatly improved over the 40 years or 30 years that they've been working on it. But it to me, I would just rather focus it myself and take the responsibility. This was a complete revolution in photography. Now, the basic concept of the camera has not really changed, and it's not changed even in the digital age. The camera is a light-tight box that allows a certain amount of light in that has been focused on film or a sensor. That is the exact same thing that they were working on in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, and Civil War, U.S. Civil War pictures were taken on cameras that use the exact same system. So that part is not revolutionary. The features are revolutionary, though. And the cameras of the 1990s, the autofocus 35mm SLRs from the 90s, would look at home sitting right next to modern digital SLRs. And the designs are very similar. So the visual appeal is about the same. They were new back then, so they had that visual appeal of the new. For some people, That is the real problem with these cameras. You can't tell a film camera from a DSLR except by looking at the back and seeing what the LCD screen looks like or doesn't have, depending on the camera that you buy. So for a lot of people, this is not a desirable camera at all. That's one of the advantages of these cameras. These cameras are really ignored in the market. You can easily, at a thrift store, pick one of these things up for in the $10 to $20 range. You can easily buy them on eBay under $50 without a lens, for a body that will use film from ISO 6 to 6400, and it has shutter speeds from 30 seconds to 1/4,000th of a second. Oh my God, these are wonderful cameras. And people ignore them because they don't have the visual nostalgic appeal. I have two of the bodies. I have two Canon EOS bodies. They're both Rebels. One's a Rebel G and one's a Rebel X. And really, you know what? I don't know the difference. They have all these features. And there were even more features that they put in these. I believe the Canon EOS Elan 7E, if I'm right on this one, it had eye tracking autofocus. So it would look at your eye and see where you were looking in the frame, and it would autofocus on the point of the frame that you're looking at, or it would send the autofocus to measure that distance. That's absolutely amazing. That's amazing to me. Okay, those are the advantages. Features. And price. They're really relatively cheap cameras. You may have on a digital SLR in your house today, if you have one of those, you may have a lens that will just pop right onto these. Not always, because there were some adjustments in the software and some other things. So it may not always work. But you could find that you have one already that will work on these cameras. They were light. They were very light because they were suddenly made of plastic. At least the consumer level ones were. And they've got that aerodynamic feel, which I think in high winds means better performance. I don't really mean that. The disadvantages for this line of cameras, one of them is that the consumer models are not very rugged. Many of the chassis were actually ABS plastic, so they couldn't be dropped very often, or they might have a light metal chassis on the interior. They were not really very rugged. However, the good news is the electronics of this age were a generation further along in the development of electronics, and they're much more reliable than the electronics of the previous age. Now, same thing about all cameras with electronics. When the board goes, it's gone. So that camera is now a paperweight or it's landfill. So you really have to worry. Here's the deal. Is very rarely will these cameras, if they power on and you can take a picture with, you can press the shutter button and take a picture, they're going to be good. They're going to be good to go. Very rarely will you have it actuate the shutter and not be able to continue to work. They required a special battery. The camera that I described above, the Canon EOS Elan and or Canon EOS 30, it required a battery called a 2CR5, and it was a 6-volt battery. And I believe it was lithium. I'm not necessarily sure it was lithium. You may have been able to get alkaline and lithium versions of the same battery. But those batteries were difficult to find at first. Later on, they became available in the corner grocery store. For a while, they were difficult to find. And now, again, they're somewhat difficult to find. They're available through Amazon and any photography store, but that's one of the big downsides to them. That concludes the episode of SLRs from the 1990s, the Auto Everything SLRs. And this concludes the series on 35mm SLRs, on buying your first 35mm SLR. If you have any questions, I have a once monthly podcast of questions and answers. If you have a question, go to the website, getstartedwithfilm.com, and fill out the form, or send me an email, graham@getstartedwithfilm.com, and that's spelled graham@getstartedwithfilm.com, and put in the subject line whatever the subject of the question is, so I know how to organize each question. If you are on Instagram, you can follow the feed of the show at getstartedwithfilm. If you hashtag your posts, Get Started With Film, I have a pretty good chance of seeing your work, and I might feature it in the show's feed. Our music comes from filmmusic.io. This track is Poofy Reel by Kevin McLeod of Incomptech.com, and it's licensed through Creative Commons.